Welcome to the Growth Equation Podcast. We're your hosts, Brad Stahlberg
and Steve Magnus. And welcome back, or welcome to another Growth Equation Podcast. Brad, how's everything going?
Everything is going all right. Another Wednesday morning recording with you, so I cannot complain. Things are fine. Getting ready for some basketball to be back on TV. I know it's something that we've discussed in the past. There's a part of me that thinks that the amount of resources that is going into making a truncated NBA season, if you even want to call it that, and playoffs happen, is nuts and a poor use of resources and could better be spent elsewhere. And there's a part of me that is very excited to be able to watch basketball every night. So I am living that paradox.
All right. Well, at least it's better than baseball, which has started and then had, I think it was 14 to 18 players of the Miami team.
And it's just boring. The baseball just doesn't transfer well to... I mean, baseball to watch on TV, in my perspective, is kind of boring to begin with, but it's just so plain and empty. Like, a guy hits a fly ball, and it's just 6 seconds of silence. I tried to watch baseball. I made it 6 minutes, and I'm just like, I don't want to be doing this.
Dang. So, as a childhood baseball fan, I don't agree, but I also participate in a sport that is incredibly "quote unquote" boring as well. So,
yeah, maybe your sport doesn't take 3 hours.
Sometimes it maybe not quite that, but 2 hours and 20 minutes if you're watching a marathon.
Yeah, maybe you're just trained. But I challenge you and any of our listeners to try to watch baseball and let us know what you like about it, if anything. Because I'm not anti-baseball. Listen, playoff baseball is super exciting, but there is just something about an empty stadium and all that open space. And the ball's just in the air for so long, and the angles weren't tight. It just doesn't seem to lend itself well to COVID.
See, this is the difference. I figured it out right here. I am well adept and used to watching literally hours and hours of track and field in empty stadiums.
Oh, your bar is so low. Yeah, with the worst production quality. The couple track and field races I've watched, you wait an hour and a half, and then finally, you know, Meb Keflezighi breaks off the front to try to win the marathon, and they go to a fucking commercial break for 20 minutes.
Exactly. So when you live in that world, you know, baseball is full of action. It's all perspective, my man. It's all perspective. Yeah. And then, which is interesting, because if we were really concerned, this is a complete tangent, but I'll tie it back in, I promise. If we were really concerned, the amount of action in a football or NFL game is very minimal. But it seems like a lot of the stuff is going on, even though from a time standpoint, it's not. So it's interesting. But so
good
as
production value, that's something that we are going to aspire to do on this podcast. So now that we filled 3 minutes of your day with banter, we'll move into the main topic, and hopefully the various sports leagues that are coming back into play take care to protect their coaches, because coaching, ooh, you like how I did that, Steve? Coaching is very important, and coaching is what we're going to talk about today.
Yes, what we do, both in different fields, and this will be interesting because we're going to talk about coaching in general as a whole. A lot of time coaching gets defined in a sporting role because that's the world that we generally use the word coach with, right? Coach baseball, track, football, whatever, high school coach, junior high PE teacher you call coach, right? So we're used to that, but coaching is something far simpler. And I think maybe we start out with defining what coaching is, and I'll give you my definition, and then I'm curious to hear what you say. But to me, coaching is just it's just part of being on the journey towards helping someone improve their craft in whatever way that is, right? So if I'm a coach, I'm helping someone improve their craft in track, in business, in how they handle, you know, anxiety or stress or whatever have you. Like, coaching to me is just helping someone get better at something.
I have a very similar definition. The only thing that maybe is a little bit different to the definition that comes to mind right away for me is a notion of having a big toolkit and a knowledge of various tools, and then sharing those tools with an individual. And as you said, then walking with them as they try to apply those tools and figuring out which tools will work for them and which tools won't. And then also adapting your tools, because as a coach, you quickly learn that some things that you thought would work don't work. So you're constantly learning at the same time that the individual that you coach is learning.
Yeah. I mean, I like the tool analogy, because it is true, and it's why you can quickly become stagnant if you are not updating your knowledge base and your skill set and your tools in the toolbox.
So I think it's important to have both of those elements, because you've got some coaches that are brilliant on the toolkit, but they struggle to do the actual when the rubber meets the road work of walking with someone as that person tries to apply those tools. And then you've got coaches that have really, really solid, athlete or executive hands, meaning that they are perfect for going in the trenches with that person, but they don't know what they're talking about. And that's problematic too. So I think really good coaches marry a very vast and rich understanding of the toolkit, but also the ability to have strong interpersonal relationships and gear those tools toward what someone needs.
Yeah. The matching of tools to what they need is kind of where the rubber meets the road with coaching. I think coaching is all about applicability, not just the knowledge base. The knowledge base serves as the foundation, but you've got to get to the applied. And that's why I think it's interesting that, yes, the knowledge matters, but, you know, I can sit here and think of many successful sporting coaches who didn't have the deep knowledge of, let's say, physiology or the science behind it, but were brilliant on the application of it. So it's interesting how you can get to these different performance levels, paths in different ways. But anyways, let's dive into, I think a good place to start on this is, now that we've got a definition of coaching and what it means, is what does it look like to be a good coach versus a bad coach? I mean, you mentioned there on this combination of tools and knowledge, but I think it goes well beyond that.
Yeah, I agree. So in my coaching is predominantly with executives, entrepreneurs, and physicians. So these are individuals that are already quite skilled and far along at what they do. And they are also individuals that have much greater content knowledge about their craft. So I've never gone to medical school. I've never managed a huge organization, let alone even a team, and I've never started a company. So for me, the first thing that separates a good coach from a bad coach in my realm is a good coach realizes what they know and what they don't know. So I make it very clear to new prospective clients that if they want very tactical operational help, I am the wrong person. They know their business better than me. If what they want is a vast array of mental models that are broadly applicable, and then our work together is figuring out how to apply it to their various craft, then I'm probably a pretty good fit for them. So I think that the first thing is just some humility in understanding what you know and what you don't know and where you're really trying to help someone.
Yeah, and that really dives into this idea that I think ties into that of what I call is a ego coach, right? Idea where it's all about them versus a coach who's more about independence and helping people along the journey. an ego coach a lot of times won't step back and do the work to understand what they don't know, right? They'll claim that they know, you know, they have a superior knowledge on just about anything that they can handle, right? And what that does is it creates this power dynamic differential where the coach is the one with answers and the athlete or the student is the one who should follow, right? And I think that, well, that is sometimes the case, that can lead you in a lot of wrong directions as compared to a model, which we've talked about, where it's like, yes, the coach might have more knowledge and expertise, but they're on that journey together trying to lead, poke, prod, send the person into the right direction.
Mm-hmm. The ego coach, and I know that that's your framing, I really like it, the ego coach coaches toward dependence, right? So that the athlete or the person that they're coaching feels like they need them. And the coach that's overcome that ego coaches towards independence. So the best coach really coaches themselves out of a job. And what's funny is that some of the clients that I've been working with the longest, we still have our sessions. They're not as frequently. Maybe they're once a month instead of once a week or once every other week. And they are really almost more just like you and I talking, Steve, because they know the stuff. I'm just there as a soundboard and occasionally maybe to see something that they don't see. And those are some of the most fulfilling relationships. And I could sit there and try to make up problems to solve, but that defeats the purpose. Again, the goal is to coach towards independence. But once someone reaches independence, they still often want to have coaching. Because such a value of a coach, even if you're an expert on the topic, is again, just that objective lens and seeing what you don't see. So I've always kept coaching for myself, both in what I do as a creative and then also in my physical practice. And clearly, I don't quote unquote need coaching from a knowledge standpoint. I can program strength training pretty easily, but when I'm in the middle of the thing myself, I lose the ability to see clearly because it's me. So just having someone that can see clearly is super helpful. And that's a huge part of what coaching does once you have a higher level person that is independent.
You know, with the elite or professional athletes I work with, I like to say that my job transitions to preventing them from doing something dumb, right? Because it's the perspective. They have the knowledge, right? They've been in the system long enough where they know what workouts to do and what it's supposed to feel like and why they're doing it. Like, they could easily write their own training plans. They could easily coach themselves. But it's my job to be almost like this person who's a little separated, who can keep a little bit of perspective and say, you know what, we probably shouldn't do that race. Or, you know what, let's bag this workout because, yeah, you might get through it, but, you know, it's not worth it. Or on the opposite hand, to be like, you know what, we really have to do this. And like, I know you're feeling a little tired and fatigued, but we're going to go through it and then we'll adjust on the back end. And it's sometimes you need that person to have that perspective because you as the performer are so locked in on the goal or the craft that you're doing that it's hard to zoom out and understand or see the big picture. So early on in coaching, right, my job, if I'm a high school coach, is a lot more of teaching, right, of leading, of dictating what to do, until those habits and understanding and knowledge becomes ingrained. And then the rope gets a little bit longer in terms of the leeway that they have. So it's interesting, you know, to give some concrete examples, even from the college realm, is for incoming new freshmen in college, I give them all, a pretty detailed training plan of like, here's what to expect. Here's what we're going to do, all this stuff. And then as they transition into their junior and senior year, for things like, okay, how many miles per week should I run? I leave it up to them, right? I'm like, you've been doing this long enough. You know what you're supposed to do. Like, we'll have a conversation on it, but then you track it. Or what to do for their easy distance runs. I'll be like, you know what? Whether you run 9 miles, 10 miles, 8 miles, like, you're smart. You've been in the program. You figure it out. Like, you got it. And I'll just be there to observe and correct if I think we need to make an adjustment. But it's that transition from dependence to independence that is really important. And not to belabor the point, but I think one of the reasons that you don't see that transition or you don't see that model is because as a coach, it's really hard to, as you said, Brad, put yourself out of the job to like have the, you know, security to know that, like, even though you're giving them control and giving them some purpose and the ability to adjust and all that stuff, that like you're still part of this journey with them.
100%. And I think that the another way to think about it is, it, at least in the kind of coaching that I do, is there are fundamentals which you can absolutely coach toward that to me are almost non-negotiables. So these are things like your foundation of any kind of lasting performance and health. So sleep, nutrition, physical movement, balancing stress and rest, planning your day, week, year, next 5 years in a way where you are not going to burn yourself out because you are alternating between taking on challenges and being able to take your foot off the gas. So that might make up the first few months of a coaching relationship. But then after that, my job shifts from teaching concrete principles and holding people accountable to apply them to asking really good questions, or at least I try to ask really good questions that then help that individual figure out themselves what the answer is. Because I'm not, again, I'm not in their organization. I'm not in their politics or in their bureaucracy. I get as smart as I can on that stuff from them. But ultimately, I try to ask them questions to help them see their situation with a little bit more clarity. And then they ultimately make the decision. And again, I think that is that's very different than what an ego coach might do. An ego coach might go in and say, here's what you should do. I know this. But how can that person know that? They're not in the organization. They're not there day to day. So I can't know that. What I can try to do is help somebody feel confident in the decision they're making and think about it differently than they would have on their own. And I wonder, Steve, in your athletes, there's got to be a parallel, right? Like, I'm sure there are things that you completely non-negotiable in how you write training and how you coach the skill. But my guess is when it comes to like, how should I warm up for a race? Or, you know, maybe you have someone that really heel strikes and do you transition them to midfoot or not? Some of that is probably they're going to have that answer and your job is just to try to get it out of them. Yeah.
So a lot of what I like to do in my own coaching is putting people in place to make those decisions or challenge them to. So there are non-negotiables, right? There's, you know, there's a certain amount that we're going to, like, we have to train, right? We have to do runs. We have to do workouts. Like, we can't always take days off, et cetera, et cetera. Like, there's a base amount for every individual that, like, we're going to have to get in to reach their goals, right? And I'm not just talking volume of training. I'm talking, like, this volume, intensity, density of work, right? But within that, right, there is variation. And I think it's important to like allow your athletes to explore. You mentioned the warm-up example, and I think that's a great one. So one of national caliber athletes I had in at the University of Houston, Brian Barraza, did a very, very short warm-up. So most people, you know, do a pretty extensive warm-up. For those who aren't runners, you go run a little bit, maybe a mile or two, then you come back and you do probably, you know, 10 to 15 minutes of drills. Like, you'd see things like skips and butt kicks and leg swings and all these drills to kind of loosen the body up, right? And then you do some accelerations and some strides and maybe some dynamic stretching and all that stuff, right? And the whole warm-up routine before a race generally takes 45 minutes to an hour. With Brian, like, he said after experimenting, he was like, I felt best when I just did a jog, did a couple leg swings, and did a stride or two, and then I was good to go. So his whole warm-up routine, if you like really condensed it, might have taken 20 to 30 minutes, right? So almost half of what normal is in the sporting cross-country track world. And that's totally fine, right? So what I encourage my athletes to do, and Brian was just on the extreme of one end, is to say, okay, here's a general warm-up, right? Here are the things that I think are important for a warm-up to do, right? It's to get your body temperature up, your legs moving a little bit, right? Some elasticity and reactivity in there. Get your legs feeling good. Get your body warmed up. You're breathing a little elevated so that when you get on the line, you're not fatigued, but you're warmed up and ready to go. And then I'd outline, here are some of the tools that you can use to do this, right? I'd show them some drills, all that stuff. But then I give them the flexibility, make it up, right? Figure out what works for you. How do you do that? Try it in practice. What makes you feel good? Try it in races. Did this make you feel good in the first lap of the race or the first mile of the cross-country race? If not, then you need to adjust your warm-up. Mm-hmm. And I would give them the freedom and flexibility to adjust it, sometimes to extreme degrees.
Yeah. It reminds me a little bit of a framework that I like to use in coaching. It's called the four stages or four levels of competence. And the first level is unconscious incompetence. So you don't know that you don't know what you're doing. And with an individual in that phase, I really try to, grab the kettlebell by the horns and take control as a coach, because they don't even know that they don't know what they're doing. The second phase is conscious incompetence. So they know that they don't know what they're doing. And that is very much a didactic kind of coaching where you are still teaching, you are getting asked questions, you're providing answers, and you're helping somebody learn the principles. And in my work, this is like over 2 to 3 one-hour sessions, right? Because the people I'm working with are quite bright. Many of them come in with some knowledge. Those that don't, they're quick learners. They're paying me to coach them, so they want to learn. So we get through that very quickly. Then the third level is conscious competence. And this is where you know what you're doing, but you have to think about it and put some effort into it and be conscious of what you're doing. And this is when you might have individuals track something about their performance. You might be doing constant check-ins. There is, I said tracking, there's also maybe a measurement component. You're really having someone be very aware of the tools that they can apply and the situations that might be good fits for those tools. And that can be anywhere from a month to 10 years. Completely depends on the person, the situation that they're in. Eventually, where I want to get the people that I coach to is unconscious competence, where they don't even have to think about this stuff. It is just ingrained in what they do, and their intuition can guide them. But there are a few traps. And the first trap that I often see is people think that they're at unconscious competence and they can trust their intuition when they can't, because they didn't work their way up through those three phases. And then the other trap that I see is people get stuck on conscious competence. So they become very reliant on me as the coach, or on some intellectual understanding of the principle, or on feeling like they need to record something in a journal so they can share it with me. And then my job is to take a leap of faith with them and say, I'm getting in your way. You're getting in your way. You know this. Just do what's right in the moment. Don't send me a text message. Don't schedule an emergency session. You know what to do. And that's a risk for both of us. But ultimately, very similar, right, to this coaching towards dependence or independence, ultimately my goal is to get these ways of leading in performing so ingrained that they don't even have to think about it.
So that last part you mentioned, I think, is such a crucial aspect of coaching, which is often the hardest to overcome, which is this idea of dependence on the coach to help you get through things, right? You see this in the business world, the executive world, as you mentioned. You see this a lot in the athletic sports world, where the athlete, because of how they've been coached, all of a sudden thinks that they need the coach to be there to guide them, to direct them, right? And that's the ultimate, you know, downfall of this dependence model of coaching. Because when I'm not there, they should still be able to figure it out, right? And if they can't, then it's on our job as a coach to, as you said, step back, right? Put them in position, like have them take risks and see what happens. Because if we think of it, especially in the sporting world, all of the critical decisions, all of the critical points in a competition are almost always going to, you know, be there without a coach by your side, right? It's just the critical point in the race. I'm not going to be there to scream or yell or tell you what to do. The critical point in a game, right? The coach isn't going to be able to always call a timeout and talk to you or be in your ear when you're in the huddle as a quarterback or whatever have you, right? It's got to be the individual, and we have to train these athletes up. And it's not only from a decision-making standpoint, but I also think if you step back and you think of how do you motivate individuals, it's from that standpoint too. Because if they become dependent on external motivation, me as a coach pushing, prodding them the whole way or yelling and screaming at them, then the moment we need them to be motivated to make the right decision, it has to come from within, right? And my example is I'm not picking on strength coaches because I'm friends with a lot. I love a lot of them. But like the screaming in their face all the time to perform, right? I get it, you know, in certain circumstances in the college setting, like it makes sense. It works, right? You get super amped, you get super motivated. But the athlete needs to figure out how to get to that point on their own, right? Not with me yelling in their face to get to be able to, you know, get the bar up or whatever have you.
Metallica. That's how I get there on my own.
but that's a great point. And, you know, I know we've talked about them before, but Dan John, a great strength coach, the way he explains it is pretty simple, is where do you need to be? 1 to 10. Where do you need to be for this event? Mm-hmm. For throwing a shot put or putting a shot put, I might need like 8 or 9. So I got to get myself amped, not from the coach, but from myself, whatever that is. If I'm lining up to run a marathon, then on the line, I might...
2, what?
Right. I need a 2. So instead of getting myself amped, I need to figure out how to bring myself down. And like, it's a very simple model there. But I think like, the key in all of that is, yes, a coach can help with that. Yes, a psychologist can help, whatever on the front. But like at the end of the day, the athlete or the person needs to have the tools and their own tool belt to be able to get to that place.
And that gets back to coaching the tools first. And that is more of an active, hands-on, conscious competence phase where you're really working with someone to then eventually being able to let go as a coach and then giving your athlete or physician or entrepreneur or executive the confidence to let go themselves. I think that something that I often use to help bridge that gap is, so let's say that I've got someone, and I can make a really concrete example, that I've been meeting with every other week, but they will contact me in between when something comes up that they want, you know, my opinion on. And at first I'll give that opinion and I'll couch it in why I'm giving it. But eventually it gets to a point where I start to feel like there's a little bit of dependence going on. I don't want that person to feel like I'm abandoning them. So what I'll tell them is for these decisions, and they're usually around decisions, write down what you're feeling in the moment. what decision you make and why you made it, and just keep that in a notebook and don't reach out to me. And when we meet next in 2 or 3 weeks, we'll go through all of those decisions. And what's fascinating is that what people end up seeing is that in the moment, what felt like such a catastrophic, or that's the wrong word, but such a tricky decision that they needed my help with a couple days or weeks of removal, they look back on it and they're like, oh, like that wasn't such a big deal. So I think that's another really important interim step. And that never really goes away, right? Because when you're coaching someone for years and years, and the person that you're coaching is on the path of mastery and they've really got it figured out, so much of what you're doing is just, I mean, at least in my world, they're paying me a decent chunk of change for a protected hour to reflect together. And I think that that's still really valuable, but that's very different than me telling them what to do.
Yeah. And, you know, I think one of the things, again, as I said, when we think of coaching, we tend to think of athletics and sports and all that stuff. But I think what you're highlighting there is that we often get stuck on these early two phases of your framework there, because that's what we remember. That's what we think coaching is. And we may not have experienced this last phase of just having someone to reflect on the process or bring perspective to the whole endeavor and see that as coaching. And I think that's a shame. And I think that also points to another disparity that I think in coaching that often occurs is that, not as much as in athletics, but to a degree, is that coaches is that those who might need coaching the most cannot get it, right? So they cannot progress past those, let's say, first two phases, because they might need a coach to get them to that final phase.
Mm-hmm. 100%. And that's a huge issue, is then you have somebody that doesn't get that. And in the corporate world, you see that a lot with middle managers. So individuals that don't necessarily have the financial resources because their income's not great enough to be able to afford a coach, and the organization's not providing them with coaching because they're worried about the executives getting the coaching, but it's actually some of those middle managers that could benefit the most from the coaching. I'm sure that you see that in athletics too, where sometimes you know more about the sports world than me, and LeBron James is a special case. Maybe he's not the right example, but all the resources that go towards LeBron James, imagine if those went towards some of the players that perhaps needed a little bit more help. And again, that might not be the right example, because in the NBA, the range is so restricted to phenomenal talent. But my point is, I think oftentimes we coach somebody to a level where they're great and then they still get all the resources, when in fact, so much of the benefit is getting them to that level.
Well, let's think of it like this. So working in the college world for a while, let's take the an area where high school students get a lot of coaching, or a certain area, which is SAT performance, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. You get a certain population that hires really good SAT coaches, okay, who teaches the principles of the test, the tips and tricks, so that they can ingrained on like how to take this test, not even the knowledge base behind it, but how to take this test and how it's graded and how that matters, versus you have the person, and I was like this, who took no coaching, no prep work, and just showed up on some random Saturday, sat down and took the test, right? Now, some people can afford to like get the cheat sheet guide from the coach, right? To get the knowledge of how this process unfolds. Others, maybe because of financial reasons or because of lack of knowledge of what to do, don't. And that can make a large difference in terms of scholarships, what schools or colleges people get into and all that stuff. And that's just based on, again, simply the ability to hire someone who can coach you up and someone and not being able to.
Steve, you think I can go on a little rant? Will you hold me to 3 minutes here?
All right, I got my stopwatch out. I'm ready.
See, look at that, coach. Talk about I do not yet have unconscious competence for my rants. I need to pay very close attention, otherwise we lose listeners. All right, my ACT rant, and you could say the same thing for the SAT, is that it is the stupidest test and the stupidest measure of a gateway to success. And I use myself as the perfect case study for why it's stupid. So I struggled mightily with standardized tests. When I first took the ACT, I probably scored between, if I think back, 24 and 25. So not terrible, but certainly not an elite score. So then over 3 months, I got into one of those Kaplan, you know, test prep classes, and I had a tutor that I met with once a week because my family had the resources and the knowledge to do that. My score went from a 24 to a 30. I did not get, what is that? See, I can't even do math. That's my point. I did not get 25% or 20% smarter in 3 months on like general aptitude. No, I learned how to take the test. And then as a result, I scored really well and I was able to get into a very good university and have a very good job out of that university because I performed well at the university. But clearly, I didn't perform well at the university because of this general intelligence measured by the test, because my actual intelligence was a 24. I should have never gotten into the University of Michigan. I got in because I could afford to hire a tutor and because my family and I knew that that made sense. But I still performed well because the test doesn't matter. So that's my rant against standardized testing. I'm not a policy education wonk. I know that there are all kinds of problems in terms of how to try to more objectively judge someone's intelligence, but I can tell you that the ACT is not it. The ACT is very good at figuring out who is good at taking the ACT. It's kind of like CrossFit, one of our other favorite topics. CrossFit makes you very good at CrossFit. CrossFit does not necessarily make you good at running, biking, swimming, powerlifting. Being good at taking the ACT means that you are good at taking the ACT. All right, coach, how did I do? Did I keep
great.
It 3 minutes?
Yes, 2 minutes and 7 seconds. So,
all right. Bring us back on track. Save us.
I don't know if I can save you, but I'll try. You know, I think, but that is like the perfect example there, because it's like coaching is about making an impact in performance. And in this case, it seems to you, based on your example, and then also some good research out there, which I've read before, it makes a significant performance leap for those who have good coaching in this area. Now, is that fair? Is it not fair? I'm not sure, but I think it tells that the measure, as you said, doesn't teach or doesn't measure what we think it is. Now, I'll go the other direction, right? If we look at running, okay, a very basic sport, how fast can you run a mile in? Okay, coaching, does it matter? Absolutely. But the difference between, let's say you get a solid high school coach and the world's best coach, the difference that makes is going to be very small, right? Mm-hmm. Very small, because it's more about, hey, are you going to put in some good work, et cetera, et cetera? How, you know, what are your physical capabilities? Are you working hard? And the reason we know this is pretty straightforward. If you go through history, there are some athletes who have run really freaking fast doing what we would consider in modern, you know, coaching education as absolutely trash or horrible workouts. But they performed really, really well. Okay. And the reason is that gap is so small. So it's not that coaches don't make a difference. They do. And outside of the performance world, but it's not this massive gap that determines whether, let's say, you get a college scholarship or not, for the most part, right? If you're capable of running at a, let's say, a college level, then like, as long as you're doing some sort of solid training, like you're going to get to that, you're going to be kind of where you need, you're going to be in the ballpark of where you need to go. So I think it's interesting on these, like, on this coaching side, all right, we have areas where it makes a large difference that is very significant. We have areas where it probably helps, but isn't the be-all, end-all. And if you look at what happens in the world of youth sport, is a lot of times we overemphasize the, oh, I'm going to hire a private coach, I'm going to get all this extra training, I'm going to do all this stuff, when your high school coach was probably good enough.
100%. I think another interesting parallel, or not parallel, but an off-road from that concept is just the notion of coaches having pattern recognition. And that's another thing that you get out of coaching. So if I coach, I don't know how many I've coached, 30 different physicians over the past few years, lots of them are struggling with different versions of the same problem. And what I bring to the table isn't this magical knowledge of how to be a better physician. It's simply that I've observed closely how 29 other people have tried to work through this problem, and I've picked up on some patterns. And I think that's another thing that, like you mentioned, the difference between a good high school coach and a good elite level coach. Well, in running, especially for something like the mile, a shorter race, if there aren't that many patterns to observe, as long as the high school coach cared, they probably can solve the problem almost as well as the elite coach because the patterns that they've seen are similar. And maybe that brings us to another principle, which is just caring. Like, the coach that cares the most is the coach that's going to be the most present and patient and pick up on those patterns and not just come to the practice or come to the coaching session, do their work for an hour, and then check the you-know-what out. But they're going to, after that practice or after that session, in their brain, they're going to say, oh, here's how I tried to address this problem. Let's see how it unfolds. They're going to check in with the athlete or client. They're going to watch the race, see how the person performs. And then they're going to update their model for, hey, this is the solution I pointed at that problem. Did it work or not? And then when the next person comes across that problem, they'll continue to update that heuristic in their mind. They'll continue to update that pattern. To me, that's a coach that cares. A coach that doesn't care literally just comes in, does the session, and then leaves. And it's not about, like, you know, crying when your athlete or your person does poorly or does well. That's like very like saccharine sentimental caring. To me, caring is just treating it like a craft, building models that you can call upon and using them. That's it to me.
So, yeah, I think you hit on two things there that are incredibly important, is that the pattern recognition comes through caring because you're giving the attention to what you're doing, right? And going back to something we talked about at the beginning is this kind of knowledge versus tools idea. Is some, and I brought up, some really good coaches might not have this in-depth knowledge but have phenomenal applicability. And I'm thinking in general, a coach who used to be at Georgetown and then coaches New Jersey, New York Track Club, Frank Gagliano, who phenomenal coach, doesn't really care about the physiology or whatever, but is a master at caring and then pattern recognition over his, 60-year career, 50-year career, is he's figured out what has worked by paying attention, making note of it, and adjusting, right? And I think that gets you a very, very long way. But I think it's interesting is that in all of our education or all of our coaches ed work, is we put a high degree of emphasis on the knowledge, which is understandable, but there's much less of, okay, experience and pattern recognition is what like helps get us most of the way or get us part of the way. Like, that needs to be front and center in your coaching practice. Because again, you take a high school coach, you take someone like yourself who has no idea or no experience, you know, starting a company. But if you get enough of enough pattern recognition where you've seen A, B, and C, maybe in different contexts, you can start connecting things. And then you can start offering questions and then offering solutions and poking and prodding people in the right direction because you've seen a similar a movie or a similar film play out, right? So that to me is one of these huge principles that I think matters a lot but isn't talked about too much.
For sure. And again, I think that part of it is, you know, in my world, the the entrepreneur that comes to me that already has funding for their company, I mean, that's like to you getting the runner that's winning marathons that's a pro. So I don't need, like, you don't need to teach them how to win marathons because they're already doing it. I don't need to teach them how to start a company because they've already done it. What I need to do is just pay close attention to their situation. And in a schema that I like to use, I come back to all the time, is I try to see things that they don't see and point those things out and then talk about them. I mean, that is literally my job more than half the time in coaching, is just that, to see what someone doesn't see, point them out, and then talk about it. And it might be that, oh, hey, you know, Brad, that's actually just a pebble that you're looking at. It's not important. And I say, oh, are you sure? Yeah, well, tell me why. And they tell me why, and then they've had the chance to reflect on it. But sometimes, and why they pay me to coach them, is the thing that I see what they don't see, it's actually not a pebble. You know, it's a pebble that's going to grow into a huge rock. And they come to the solution for what to do about it. I'm simply seeing it. And again, to me, that's much more in that stage of like conscious competence or unconscious competence. Those first two stages are just about laying down the foundation. And you'd be shocked, Steve, how even physicians, and coach a lot of physicians that, and physician leaders that are supposed to know in healthcare, they don't sleep, they don't exercise, their diets are terrible. So some of that is just very basic teaching. But after that, in my world, it really does shift to seeing what people don't see, trying to ask good questions. And it goes from leading someone down the path to walking the path with them, and at times following them down the path. I mean, there are so many times when someone will come to me and they'll say, hey, like, you know, I'm trying to raise my second round of capital in this, that, and the other, and I think this is what I'm going to do. And I'm like, great. Like, I don't know what you should do. I've got some pattern recognition from others, but you feel strongly, let's do it. And it's okay as a coach to follow someone down the path as long as you're paying close attention so that you can help them see what they don't see and ask good questions.
Yep. Couldn't agree more. I mean, I think like it sounds very simple, but like once you get past the, we'll say the nail the basics and the teaching phase, it becomes the attention phase of like paying attention, aware of your surroundings, aware of where you're going. And then, you know, if you need to, like pulling back on the athlete or the you know, the individual, or nudging them in another direction. But like the only way you get there is if you have that attention and focus. And I think that's why it's important when you're in the act of coaching, regardless of what you're doing, to make sure that your attention and focus is on the craft or on that athlete or on the individual. And in my world, what happens sometimes is we shift that focus from, like, let's say, watching an athlete work out to what is the watch saying in terms of how fast they're running, right? We've now shifted the focus towards this one parameter, which might matter a little bit, but we might miss these other patterns, these other cues. And I think, you know, not to go down another rabbit hole, but in the world of athletics, sometimes the data, which can be good, takes your focus and attention off of the pattern recognition of other things that might be more important in terms of making actionable decisions.
Couldn't agree more. I think that is it in a nutshell. That's good coaching. So maybe to close, Steve, if somebody is listening that is a coach, what would your two big pieces of advice or takeaways be for that person? And then the other question that I'd like to ask ourselves is, if you're listening and you don't have a coach, but you want a coach, whether it's to be a better runner, a better executive, a better writer, you name it, what would our pieces of advice be for them in terms of finding a coach?
Oh, man. You know, I think we hit on the two main things that I always tell coaches, which is keep your ego out of it, you know, or leave your
simple, not easy.
Yeah, leave your ego at the door. But I think there's a couple things. So I'm just gonna rattle off a couple things that come to my mind off the top of my head. Number one is that everyone you're working with deserves coaching. So I think that's important to understand, because like in my world, it's easy to give the coaching to the best and then like kind of let the you know, lower ability level or performance standard kind of just go for a ride. But I think you have to, if you're going to agree to coach someone, you got to coach everybody up. Okay. The other thing I think for a coach that I would give advice is always try to surround yourself with good mentors and good collaborators in that coaching field, because they're going to challenge you and they're going to help you grow and they're going to aid your pattern recognition and accelerate that to the nth degree. So if you can go, if you're a track coach, then you need to go find, you know, the best track coach in your area and just spend a day at practice watching what they watch, you know, asking what they're picking out and looking for, and do that. That'll accelerate your pattern recognition to the nth degree. Another thing that I would say is, if you're just getting into it, is also to help that pattern recognition is take on individuals so you get a diverse array of experience. Don't just, you know, only try and coach, you know, people who are at this level or what have you. Like, the more experience you have, the more patterns you see. That's why I'm very fortunate and very glad that I've coached at the high school, college, and professional level, because there are some things that I pull for pro athletes that I used or recognized when I coached, you know, 14, 15 year olds. So it's that wide range. So that would be the advice I'd give. Just to answer the second half of your question, then I'll turn it over to you, is where should someone go if they need coaching? Well, I think it's ask around for people, for recommendations from people who seem to be doing well in their craft. And then I think it's mostly, you know, finding people who A, will care about your progress, and then B, who have some sort of, who seem to be like they are the type who will help bring you along in this journey and coach towards independence, and not someone who's going to be the kind of dictator type coach who just like promises you results if you follow exactly their program, and their program is the best and the only way to get to, you know, the top. If someone is selling you that, run away. Mm-hmm.
The only thing that I would add, and I know that this is embedded in your answer, is I would just ask someone, well, what's your toolkit? So, you know, whether that is some formal education, whether that is, hey, I've written these books on these principles and I apply them, whether that is I've studied cognitive behavioral therapy, whatever that toolkit is, it's what's your toolkit? And then it's how do you apply it? And some people are going to benefit from a coach that is very routinized and has a framework. And then week one, you do this. And week two, you do that. And week three, you do that. Some people are going to find that tedious and benefit from a coach that says, I have full confidence in this toolkit, but I'm going to meet you where you are. And there's no right or wrong way to go about it. That's just a coachy fit. And then I think the other important question to ask is, have you worked with other individuals like me? And the last question to ask is, do you have coaching, or when was the last time you were coached on something? And that's a really telling one for me, because I want a coach that either is currently being coached or has been coached, because then they really understand the value of it. And you learn so much when you're coached yourself.
That is true. And I think, you know, that gets back to that mentors and collaborators and all of that good stuff, is I think as you go along in your career, you know, we talk about pattern recognition, but a very good coach and a good friend of ours, Vern Gambetta, always likes to say, do you have 30 years of experience, or do you have 1 year of experience repeated 30 times? And I think that is the key there, is that whether it's still getting coaching yourself, whether it's, you know, surrounding yourself with others or having a collaborative group, whether it's, you know, continually doing education in your field, like good coaches always strive to make sure their kit is sharp and ready to use, and then also expanding in case new tools came out to be able to use those successfully.
Love it. I think that's a pretty good place to wrap for today, Steve. So coach toward independence, not dependence, and care. I mean, that's what it comes down to. And know your shit. You know, you can't fake it, but remember that knowing your stuff isn't enough. You got to be able to apply it, and you also have to be able to have the confidence that the person that you're coaching can apply it without you. I mean, that's victory as a coach.
Couldn't agree more. So
coach yourself out of a job.
That's right. That's what we're trying to do. And sometimes it happens. So we hope that you enjoyed this. And till next time, stay safe, wash your hands, stay away from others.
Oh, man. That is the reality we live in. All right. Take care, everyone. 's for listening to the Growth Equation podcast. Learn more about our work and find show notes at our website, www.thegrowtheq.com. Follow us on Twitter at B Stahlberg and at Steve Magnus. And if you like what you listen to, please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast, as this goes a long way in helping it reach others.